We're not here today to consider or to observe the millennial age. That's over. The 7 days of the Feast of Tabernacles are behind us. This is a special day. But I don't know if you ever noticed that it is a day that is rarely mentioned in the entire Bible. Leviticus 23 presents what we could call, to some degree, a quandary. Because it talks about the Feast of Tabernacles, but whoever wrote this, it seems, can't count. Because the Feast of Tabernacles is 7 days, but it talks about the eighth day. What is this eighth day, and what is it all about? It doesn't tell us here. But we have come to realize that it has its own separate and distinct purpose, and the religions of this world are largely ignorant of the purpose of what we call the last great day. Leviticus 23, and we're in the latter few verses of this chapter. Let's begin in verse 34. Leviticus 23:34. Speak unto the children of Israel, saying, the 15th day of this seventh month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days unto the Lord. On the first day shall be an holy convocation. You shall do no servile work therein. 7 days you shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord. On the eighth day shall be a holy convocation. Unto you, and you shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord. It is also a solemn assembly, and you shall do no servile work therein. Up to verse 39. Also in the 15th day of the seventh month, when you have gathered in the fruit of the land, you shall keep a feast unto the Lord 7 days. On the first day shall be a Sabbath, and on the eighth day shall be a Sabbath. Did they have 8 day weeks back then? No. But that's all that's said. Now, if you went over to the Deuteronomy 16, written later, this was written in retrospect, but Deuteronomy 16, you'll see that this day isn't mentioned at all. Verse 13, you shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days. After that, you have gathered out your corn and your wine. And you shall rejoice in your feast, you and your son and your daughter and your manservant and your maidservant and the Levite and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow that are within thy gates. 7 days shall you keep a solemn feast unto the Lord in the place which the Lord shall choose, because the Lord thy God shall bless you in all your increase and all the works of your hands. Therefore, you shall surely rejoice. And that's all it says. No mention of the eighth day, let alone what it's for. Thankfully, we have the Gospel of John. And if you go there, we're going to learn a little more about this day. And it's in John chapter 7, about verse 37. Because these days were kept, and we don't know that the peoples of Israel fully understood what they were keeping, but they kept them. And we can see in the first century that the eighth day was also still being kept. Verse 37, in the last day, that great day of the feast, and this is where we get the name for this day. Thankfully, John preserved the record here. That great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried, if any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. He that believes on me, as the scriptures have said, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living waters. We are today observing a day that is not so much for us. This is a day that is for the rest of society, for all who have ever lived. Christ's declaration there If any man thirst, let him come. This is that period of time that is referred to later in the book of Revelation, is that period of whosoever will. Because you see, in our generation, and we can read of it, and I'm sure we're all familiar with John 6:44, that no man can come unto the Father unless he is drawn. This last great day represents a very different day. This is the period of time in which each individual can make his own decision as to whether or not to respond to the call of God. That same opportunity doesn't exist at the present time, and we can certainly see that just by looking back through history and even in the modern day. What percentage of people are called of God? What percentage of society is responding to God's call? And as was mentioned last night, either God is inept or he has a plan to do things a little differently than we might imagine. There is a period of time in which God is going to call a few. We know that as the first fruits. James chapter 5 opens up an interesting consideration. And James wasn't alone in understanding this particular thing. He was writing to a people who understood the phrase that he was using. People today don't necessarily understand it as well as they did it back in the early days. But James, in chapter 5, verse 7, refers to, as we can see from the text, the end time. Be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husbandman waits for the precious fruit of the earth, and has long patience for it, until he receive the early and the latter rain. What did James mean? And why did he make a comparison between Christ's return and the farmer gathering in his fruit? Well, James was making reference to another interesting passage in Joel. Again, very familiar to us, Joel chapter 2, a couple of books after Daniel. Joel chapter 2, verse 21 to 32. This is what James was referring to. Fear not, O lands, be glad and rejoice, for the Lord will do great things. Be not afraid, you beasts of the field, for the pastures of the wilderness do spring forth. The tree bears her fruit. The fig tree and the vine do yield their strength. Be glad then, you children of Zion, and rejoice in the Lord your God, for he has given you the former rain moderately, and he will cause to come down for you the former rain and the latter rain in the first month. And the floors shall be full of wheat, and the vats shall overflow with wine and oil. And I will restore to you the years that the locusts have eaten, and the cankerworm, and the caterpillar, and the palmer worm, my great army which I sent among you, and you shall eat in plenty, and be satisfied, and praise the name of the Lord your God that has dealt wondrously with you, and my people shall never be ashamed. You can see in that a millennial allusion. And you shall know that I am in the midst of Israel, and that I am the Lord your God, and none else, and my people shall never be ashamed. And in verse 28, he shifts gear. And it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream dreams. Your young men shall see visions. And also upon the servants and upon the handmaids in those days will I pour out my spirit. And I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord come. And it shall come to pass that whosoever, notice that word, shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be delivered. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem shall be deliverance. as the Lord has said, and in the remnant whom the Lord shall call. The rest are going to be called. The remnant, those that remain, those that are left, will be called. It's a question of when. They will be called up into a world that has been ruled by Christ and His Spirit-born saints for 1,000 years. And we have positive indication of that in Revelation chapter 20, a verse we all know well. But it tells us something. Revelation chapter 20. We should look at verse 6 to begin with. Blessed and holy is he that has part in the first resurrection. On such the second death hath no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. Verse 5. But the rest of the dead lived not again till the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection that he's referring to in verse 6. The rest of the dead are not going to be resurrected until after the 1,000 years. And those who are resurrected are going to be resurrected into a world that has already been governed by Christ and His saints. They are already, they have 1,000 years of experience behind them. So they are going to be ready and able to work with the rest of the dead who are raised after the 1,000 years. The 1,000 years are represented by the 7 days of the Feast of Tabernacles. This is something we know well. But it's the next day after. That is the day that is represented by this day, the last great day of the feast, the 8th day, as it's referred to. The day that follows. And it's interesting that many of the people of this world worship on the 8th day. Not aware of what it signifies, that perhaps they are to be called and have their mind open in that day. But we know that there is another day coming. This is the day in which we rehearse a certain future of a society without hope. Something else is going to occur, and this is earlier, this was in the period of time of the Feast of Tabernacles, or the Great Millennial Age, Revelation chapter 11, verse 19. Revelation 11, in verse 19, and the temple of God was opened in heaven, and there was seen in his temple the ark of his testament. And there were lightnings and voices and thunderings and an earthquake and great hail. The temple of God is going to be open. Open why? Open for what? Open for business. The temple is going to be opened to a greater array of people than have ever known the experience. And they're going to see in it the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of which covenant? Does that ark still apply to the New Covenant era? It certainly has application in the post-New Covenant era, the Millennial Age. But keep in mind where the Ark of the Covenant was kept. It was kept behind the veil in the Holy of Holies. The temple is going to be open like it was at the moment of Christ's death, when the veil was torn from top to bottom, and what was in there, and the Ark of the Covenant was not in there at that point in time, but it is pictured here as being in there. And to see it, the veil obscuring the Holy of Holies is going to be opened, just as it was at Christ's death. The world is going to have access to the temple. They are going to be considering, they are going to see the Ark of the Covenant. And what is in the Ark of the Covenant? Paul tells us. Aaron's rod, a little bowl of manna as a reminder of that first manifestation of Christ. He was the manna that was with them in the wilderness. But it also contains the Ten Commandments. They're inside that ark. And in some side pouches of the ark were the statutes and the judgments. God told them to put them in the side of the ark. Guess what? The things that the world thinks are all done away are going to be vividly represented to human society. The temple is going to be opened. Back to Revelation 20. We're going to see something else that's going to be opened. In verse 12. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God. And the books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. Now, last night we looked at this verse in greater detail. But verse 12 is referring to that resurrection that occurs after the 1,000 years. And the books that are opened are the books of the Bible. It's going to be opened to their understanding. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. What's the point of opening the book of life? Wasn't the book of life emptied of all names at the first resurrection, where all of Christ's saints are made spirit beings? If that's the case, then whose name is left in the book of life? Did Christ miss anybody? Or are new names going to be added into the book of life? That's why that book is open. That's why it says the books of the Bible are going to be open to people's minds in a way that they never have been before. And they will have the possibility of having their names added to the book of life. That is what we picture when we observe these days. But then we have another thing to consider. That the world as we know it right now is going to be dramatically changed, I would say, in our lifetimes. We have seen things happen in the last few years. Things that we thought would never have happened, they've happened. Society is going to be dragged through the proverbial knothole before the end of this age. And to some degree, we with it. On December 7th, 1941, an event happened that changed the world as we knew it then. That was a little before my time, but not that much. A day known as the Day of Infamy, a Day of Infamy, which gave rise to a group of people that have been called in modern times the greatest generation. People who had grown up in the Great Depression, people who had a moral fiber very different than what we see today, rose up to the challenge that was faced in World War II, and thankfully preserved freedom and preserved justice and preserved the American ideals and provided them to the rest of the world, who may have shared the ideals but didn't necessarily share the military might to be able to preserve them. Who knows what kind of a horrible world we'd be living in had that generation not stepped up to the plate. On September 11th, 2001, we had another world-changing event. And for a brief time, we saw a little bit of that greatest generation come to the surface, but it didn't last very long. People were interested in returning to church. There was a rise in attendance, but it faded fairly quickly. We don't have the same moral character. We don't have the same structure in society that we had back in 1941. I don't think ours is the greatest generation. And when things begin to happen, it's hard to say how we're going to respond to it. But one thing I do know is that we have a major segment of our population, and it's growing, it seems, all the time, that despises the moral standards that this country was founded upon, and even more blatantly despises God and the things of God. They may mask it behind anti-religion, but if you read between the lines in what they say and in what they represent, you have to wonder about that person. When did they first begin hating God? Because that's the bottom line. That's the gist of it. Back when I was about 5 or 6 years old, the communists had recently taken over in China. In the late 40s, a missionary to China happened to get a hold of a newsreel of the day, because the Chinese wanted to expunge Christianity from their country. And they made up this newsreel. And I suppose the purpose of the newsreel was to discourage any remaining Christians in the land. But what they did is they took this father and his two young daughters. The father was probably in his late 30s, and his older daughter was about 9, and his younger daughter was about 5. They strapped a board to their backs that stuck up above the top of their head. And they asked the father, "Are you a Christian?" And he answered in the affirmative. And they asked him, "Will you give up Christianity?" And he indicated that he would not. And they shot him in the back of the head. The reason for that board was to keep the brain splatter from coming back on the man shooting him with a pistol. This was very graphic and very real, and I can recall it to this day, even though it was like 50 years ago, almost 50 years ago. But he next went to the daughter, the 9-year-old daughter, asked the same questions. And her answer was, "I am my father's daughter." And they shot her in the back of the head. And they took the 5-year-old girl. Same question. And she said, "I am my father's daughter." It's a very powerful picture. But I wonder if we today have the same character, the same conviction. Should we be in a similar situation? You have to wonder. But this world is going to be dragged through a knothole. There's going to be changes like we wouldn't believe. We've seen some of those changes coming. The word change is on everybody's lips, but it's not the kind of change that we need, and it's not the kind of change that is going to make a difference. There is a bombshell incident that's going to happen, and we can read of it in Luke chapter 10. If we thought 9/11 was a world changer, wait till this happens, and perhaps it will happen subtly, and perhaps it will be dramatic, we don't know. But Christ saw it, and he spoke of it in Luke 10, verse 18. "And he said unto them, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven." Now we know that there is going to come a period of time when Satan is going to be cast out from heaven finally. He is going to come down to this earth, and he is going to ravage the earth because he knows he has but a short time. And I'm going to count on your familiarity with that particular verse rather than go to it. But the focus of his wrath is going to be particularly upon the people of God. When that happens, this world will never be the same at least not up until the last trumpet. Insanity will rule. Now, we've already intruded a little bit into the world of insanity. We have governmental insanity. We think that we can borrow our way out of debt. How many of you do this? You owe $200,000? I'll fix that. I'll go get a loan and pay it off. And we're borrowing from our enemies. In fact, the same people that I was talking about in that story about the father and his two girls. We're borrowing from them, of all things. Are they going to want payback someday? And what we're borrowing is going to be imposed on our children and grandchildren. They say every child born today has $150,000 debt on their back due to what we're doing today. Is our government insane? What can we say? Doesn't sound smart to me. We have corporate insanity. Big CEOs get in control of major corporations and they run them into the ground and ruin them, and we give them massive multi-million dollar bonuses. Simply because it's in a contract and the lawyers will run up the bill if you don't pay them. Some of those guys should be shot, but we're giving them multi-million dollar golden umbrellas to jump ship. We have academic insanity. Never mind evolution being taught everywhere, but we have the rejection of our national heritage and an effort to expunge all knowledge and all mention of God. When we understand cause and effect, which Fred alluded to, when we do that, there is a consequence. God notices, I'm sure. We've lost many of our rights in the last few years. We're losing right now our right to engage in free and open trade. Capitalism is under attack. We're losing our right to set compensation, partly because of the excesses of the corporate world, but there's other reasons. We're losing the right to make personal medical decisions. We've already lost the right to smoke cigarettes. I'm not recommending it. I'm just saying we've lost the right to smoke cigarettes while making marijuana legal. You know, one is a great moral sin, and the other is coming on strong. We've lost the right to make decisions regarding energy usage. We've lost a long time ago the right to decide what is taught in schools. We've lost the right to decide what form of corporal punishment to employ. God has some standards about corporal punishment. You could be jailed for following what's in your Bible. Within bounds, of course. God doesn't condone beating, but He does condone the right kind of corporal punishment. We are losing the right to sell your home without making costly upgrades that may even put you in upside down with respect to being able to sell your home. Our government sees that as a good thing. And we are losing our right to exercise religious beliefs publicly. Does this sound like a nation that is blessed of God if we continue on this path? God has told us in places like Amos 3:7. Amos 3:7. He's told us something that I think should be very comforting. At the same time, to a degree, alarming. But in Amos 3:7, he says, "Surely the Lord God will do nothing, but He reveals His secret unto His servants, the prophets." And a counterpart to that is in Revelation 10:7. Do we want to know where this is all going to go? Revelation 10:7, but in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he has declared to his servants, the prophets. I want to look at some of the things that God has told us about the age in which we live. Because I think it's going to be important for us as we survive this age to know what's going on. But to know more than that, that God has predicted, he has told us what's going to happen for a particular reason. And we'll finish with that reason. But I want to show you some of the things first. And this list could be three times as long as I've got here. But I'm just going to hit a few highlights. Looks like about a dozen here. Isaiah 3:12. We're going to be doing a lot of flipping here. Isaiah 3:12. This is a general statement as to the world condition. And I think it explains a lot of why society is going the way it's going. Isaiah 3:12. As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, they which lead you cause you to err and destroy the way of your paths. Did our founding fathers have it right? Does 225 years of history or 240 years of history tell us anything? Why would we tear that down? But as for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. Children today are the cultural leaders. It's our young people that are setting the standards and are setting the pace. It used to be that the elders did that. And our society is becoming effeminized. Who would have thought, even as late as 1950 or the later 50s, who would have thought that society would take the drift that it is? It isn't just so women in positions of rulership. It's the whole mentality of the society is working now more on feelings than on practical realities. Now, to some degree, that's good. But when it gets overpowering, and when we make decisions based more on feelings than on practicality, you can see why we could be having problems. Society has become very different than it was throughout history. That's very insightful, because who would have thought as late as 40 or 50 years ago that such a condition would exist? But it does. Another interesting thing in Revelation 9, verse 20. Here's another generalization about society in which we live. Revelation 9:20. And this is while God is causing calamities upon rebellious mankind, and he shows somewhat of the character. Think of those people who today hate God and hate religion and hate Christianity. You would think that as they begin to be given some blunt catastrophes by God, that they would stop and think a minute. Hey, wait a minute. Am I on the right path here? In verse 20, and the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk. Neither repented they of their murderers, nor of their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their thefts. What are the major problems in society today? Look at verse 21. And I want to point out to you that sorceries is a poor translation. Sorceries is a word referring to pharmaceuticals, if you check the original Greek. Sorcerers may have used hallucinogens in their day, and perhaps that was the reason for the choice of the word. But the problem in this society that this verse 21 is referring to is murderers, drugs, sexual immorality, and theft. Aren't those the primary problems in society today? And God is telling us, even when He begins to intervene in a very powerful way, society is still not going to repent. And that is profound. What about those people who are living in such conditions? Because we are. And where is it going to go? Apparently, it's going to get worse. Another interesting thing we can see is in Daniel chapter 11, verse 24. Because while we're worried about our economic condition, it's not going to be that way everywhere. We can see in Daniel 11, 24, He shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. When we understand who this is and the time frame in which we're talking about, this is the European power. And another place that refers to this is in Revelation 18. And this one is clearer. Revelation 18. In about verses 9 to 17, and the kings of the earth who have committed fornication and lived deliciously with her shall bewail her and lament her when they see the smoke of her burning. This is the point in time when the nations that are the beast power are struck down. Standing afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, Alas, alas, the city Babylon, mighty city, for in 1 hour is thy judgment come. And the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buys their merchandise anymore. The merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and of pearls, these are luxuries, and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and all fine wood, and all manner of vessels of ivory, and all manner of vessels of most precious wood, and of brass, and of iron, and marble, and of cinnamon, and odors, and ointments, and frankincense, and wine, and oil, and fine flour, and wheat, and beasts, and sheep, and horses, and chariots, and slaves, and souls of men. The beast power is going to be extremely wealthy while the rest of the world is impoverished, right up to the time of the end. We can get a picture of the political structure of the beast, and I won't do that at this time, but you can take and harmonize Daniel 7 and Revelation 13 together. It's very revealing. Just briefly, let's look at Daniel 7, verses 2 to 7. Daniel 7. Daniel spoke and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse from one another. The first was like a lion, and the second like a bear, and the third like a leopard, verse 6. And after this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth, and it devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and had 10 horns. We have a beast power that is going to coalesce together from these three beasts that we see. The standing lion, and the bear, and the leopard. The fourth beast is going to possess the characteristics of all of those. And you can read that when you study Revelation 13, because the two dovetail very well, and one explains the other in greater detail. In Revelation 13, 1 and 2, regarding this particular power that is coming, Revelation 13, the same beast that we were reading of in Daniel 7. And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads. These are the 7 restorations of the Holy Roman Empire, and 10 horns upon that 7th head, and upon the horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard. Giving this in the reverse order of what you read in Daniel. Was like unto a leopard, and his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. Satan is going to be behind the rise of the end time beast power. But there is hope in Revelation 17, verse 16. There's an interesting event that's going to occur. And I mentioned this by way of presenting a hope. 7 and verse 16. And the 10 horns which you saw upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God has put it in their hearts to fulfill his will, and to agree, and to give their kingdom unto the beast, until the words of God should be fulfilled. These who coalesce together to form this fourth beast, the end time beast, are going to regret what they did. And they're going to turn around and work behind the scenes to end up destroying her. But that's a separate story in itself. But I think it's interesting to point that fact out. In Revelation 13, while we're here, let's just flip over there. Verse 2. This reinforces what I said a moment ago. 13, verse 2. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard in feet and like a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power and great authority. This is a Satan-inspired institution. In Daniel 11:37, there's another characteristic. And we're going to see these things happen. Daniel 11:37. Speaking of this same power, neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, and a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. This religious power, this beast power, is going to revert to a military approach. He's going to raise an army. This supranational world religious force is going to raise an army. It's never been done before that any great church would do such a thing. The power that's forming in the world today is going to be based largely in Europe and the Middle East. The Middle East, because of its religious component, but also at the same time because it has a grip on the world that we cannot break, and that is having vast reserves of oil. In Daniel 11, we can see a scenario developing that even Jesus Christ referred to. Daniel 11 lays out a multi-thousand-year struggle between two great powers, what is called the King of the North and the King of the South. Much of this is ancient history. But somewhere, the latter part of Daniel 11 has a modern-day application. We don't know exactly where it begins, but it's probably in the latter half. Jesus Christ referred to it. He says, when you see the abomination of desolation stand in the holy place, he was referring to this one and only place where it's talked about, and then that's in Daniel 11:31. Jesus Christ is telling us that Daniel 11 has a modern day application. And we can see some of what's going to be happening by reading this particular passage. There is going to be a modern replay of what we see here. And there's something interesting in it that I want to point out to you. But I'm going to pose to you what we can consider my own personal opinion if you want to. But I see the King of the North as being Christian Europe. And I see the King of the South as being the Muslim nations, particularly the oil-producing nations. they are going to be pushing back and forth against one another. It seems in the modern era that the king of the south is going to start the push. Now, many people have made the point that, oh no, the king of the north has to be north of Jerusalem and the king of the south has to be south of Jerusalem, and that sort of creates a little bit of a conceptual problem. But think about this. Daniel's prophecy was written in Babylon, not Jerusalem. So maybe the geographics shift a little bit. But certainly when you read of it, and certainly when you think about the possibilities in the modern age, it is far more logical to see Christian Europe as the king of the north and Muslim nations, OPEC nations, being the king of the south. But these two are going to be in contrast with one another. There's going to be a push and shove match. I won't take the time to read it, but you can read through that chapter yourself, particularly the latter half. But the king of the north is going to have intentions on invading the king of the south. And in verse 30, we see that the what it call in the King James Version, it says, "For the ships of Chittim shall come against him. Therefore, he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the holy covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant." Who are these ships of Chittim? Some translations call it Cyprus. The commentaries say these ships were a Western power in their day. In a modern day, it may be a different Western power. But these ships, some nation has a considerable navy enough to block Europe from invading the Middle East. And they're not particularly happy about that. And they go home and they develop a strategy where they are going to conspire with people who forsake the Holy Covenant. And we have to wonder what Holy Covenant that is. Could it possibly be the Constitution that was developed, I think, by the grace of God that created this nation, as well as the Christian religion in general? But we can see several references in this passage to the Holy Covenant, that there are going to be people within that particular power structure who are going to conspire from within to destroy the nation. Now, further on down, we're going to see that the second time that Europe invades the Middle East, this power is gone. Let's pick it up in verse 37. This is talking about that individual who raises himself above every god. "Neither shall he regard the god of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate shall he honor the god of forces, and a god whom his fathers knew not shall he honor, with gold and silver and so on. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the lands for gain. And at the time of the end," so we know for sure where we are here, "shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over." There's going to be a massive invasion of the Middle East, and the ships, the navy of this Western power, are no longer in the picture. Do we have an allusion to the point in time when this particular Western power loses its military capability? God says of his people that he will break the pride of their power. Not necessarily in a military defeat. As we've learned from Iraq, waging war these days is extremely expensive. If they have destroyed the economy of that world power, wouldn't it, to a great degree, achieve the same thing? Is God telling us something about our near future? You can call that speculation if you want, but I want to pose the question and I want you to think about it. Because here we see a massive navy preventing, large enough to prevent the king of the north from doing what he wants to do. And he returns home very angry about that. No more Mr. Nice Guy. And he works to destroy that Western power so that when the time comes that he does this again, that power is no longer a player. Just something to think about. Now, another major thing that we need to keep in mind is that at the time of the end, and let's go to Daniel 12, we're in that area right now, Daniel 12, we know that Satan is going to be particularly focused against the people of God, and I'm confident that some will be protected. But as we know, there is also this thing we call the end time martyrdom of saints. There will be some who are not. There are some who are going to be exposed to certain situations to make them even stronger. Daniel 12, about verse 7. And I heard the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and swear by him that liveth forever, that it shall be for a time, times, and a half. And when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. Now we think that perhaps that has already happened. But it seems to be that during the 3.5 years that there is going to be another scattering. But let's not look at the word scattering as an expulsion. Let's not look at scattering as a complete cessation. It's just scattering. We have seen in a small way what happens when God's church is scattered, because it has been due to the events that took place. But that did not stop its effectiveness. We're now working in different ways, in many more venues than we ever did before, perhaps not as powerfully. But that can change. But let's not look at the scattering of the power as an end to the power. And there's more on this. In his verse in chapter 11, let's go back a little bit. And it's right after this mention of the abomination that makes desolate. Verse 32, and such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. Is this talking about the same period of time in which they're scattered? It's certainly a very close time frame. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame and by captivity and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be helped with a little help, but many shall cleave unto them with flatteries, and some of them of understanding shall fall, to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. So while Satan's focus is going to be on the people of God, at the same time the people of God are going to be doing things that they would never have dreamed of having the opportunity to do. We're going into a very unique period in history. The scriptures say it's a time that has no parallel. Days of trouble like there have never been. The wicked will not repent, as we see. Our political leaders are going to act like silly doves. Hosea 7:11 says that. That there are going to be a people who forsake the covenant, and that's got to be a significant statement because it's mentioned so many times in Daniel 11. It's in verse 30 and 32 and other places as well. At the recent United Nations convention here that was just a few weeks ago, someone of prominence stood up before that body and said something to the effect of this, and I don't have an exact quote, but he said, no nation should be regarded as superior to any other nation. Now this sort of reflects the one world mentality that that body tends to incline toward. But it struck me when I heard that quote, and it was played several times on Sean Hannity, and unfortunately I don't have an exact quote, but the gist of it is, that we should not regard any nation in this world as superior to any other nation. Except for one thing. It's in direct violation to God's intent for His people Israel. He said He would exalt His people. In response to the promises made to Abraham, but also in response to our faithfulness to Him, Israel is going to be the nation that God is going to use. We should be leading by example now, and we're the wrong example to the worst extreme. But yes, there is a nation of people that God regards as above every other nation, not because they're superior necessarily, but simply because He has a nation that He wants to use as a model for the rest of the world, because He intends to call and save the rest of the world. And that's what this day is all about, the salvation of the rest of the world. God is going to have to restore Israel to its correct and true status before that happens. Then we have the two witnesses. And did you know that there's an exact date given for Christ's return? Maybe that surprises you. I can tell you when it is. It's exactly 3.5 days, two witnesses are killed. You knew that. You knew that, okay? So we have an exact date, so keep your eyes open. But the world has no conception of the two witnesses. And that's going to be interesting in itself. I wonder what Keith Olbermann is going to do reporting about the two witnesses. That ought to be an interesting story. How's CNN going to handle that one? We know who they are. Now, I presented to you a lot of negative things, and I kind of did it on purpose because I want you to take a moment and assess your reaction to what I've been talking about. Did you react with an anxiety? I think we all do to some degree. When we understand what's going to come in this world, it is a very anxious, it is a very disconcerting point in time. We see mention of people in society who are going to call out for rocks to fall on them to kill them. They're going to be holding their stomachs in anxiety because of what's going on. Their heart's failing them for fear, another prophecy. This world is going to be anxious to the absolute limit, to the point of almost insanity. How will we react? Do we react with anxiety, or does another question that Jesus Christ asked factor into this equation? He said, when the Son of Man comes, will He find faith in the earth? That's an odd question. Wouldn't the answer be yes? He asked it in such a way where you begin to think the answer is no. Don't the religions of this world have a good handle on prophecy? Don't they know what's going to happen? The world's religions are going to see a lot of their predictions fail. They're going to see a collapse of their prophetic scenarios, many of them. They don't understand because they don't keep these days. They don't understand what the world is going to go through. They're going to misidentify the particular religious power that is God's representative and those who are others. They're going to come to realize that their heaven and hell scenario was not correct. They're going to come to realize that their definition of the new covenant dramatically overlooks Hebrews chapter 8. And most dramatically, they're going to come to realize that the event that is called the rapture is not going to occur prior to the tribulation, but after. The world's religion is going to be challenged in their faith. Are we? The world is going to be sent a strong delusion that they might believe a lie. 2 Thessalonians 2, chapter 2, verses 10 to 12. And Ezekiel 22:30. The world is going to be gripped with all kinds of challenges to their faith. Our church endured a crisis of faith once already. Many of our people swooned and bought into the stuff that was being taught. Some were confounded and walked off and were bewildered as to what to do. And some of our people moved on in faith. That's the key component, faith. Even the elect can be deceived, Matthew 24:24 tells us. But what is our reaction? Is it high anxiety? Is it fear? Or is it excited assurance? We know these things are coming. But can we move into them and through them with the assurance of what the outcome is going to be? Did you know that we're being prayed for? John 17, verse 9. And this may put the capstone on all of these events. John 17. I'm sure that this was not a one-time event. We know that Jesus Christ is serving before the throne of God in heaven, interceding on our behalf continually. An activity that is very much in line with the message you heard yesterday. He is intervening on our behalf daily. But in verse 9, Jesus was speaking to his Father. He says, I pray for them. I pray not for the world, but for them which you have given me, for they are yours. And all mine are yours, and yours are mine, and I am glorified in them. And now I am no more in the world, but these are in the world. And I come to you, Holy Father, keep through your own name those whom you have given me, that they may be one as we are. While I was with them in the world, I kept them in thy name. Those that you have given me, I have kept, and none of them is lost, but the son of perdition, that the scripture might be fulfilled. And now I come to you, and these I speak, and these things I speak in the world, that they might have my joy fulfilled in themselves. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not in the world. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. I pray not that thou should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil. We are being prayed for. But he asks the question, when the Lord comes, will he find faith in the earth? We have been given a great deal. God says he will do nothing, but that he reveals it to his servants, the prophets. This has been revealed to every one of us, his servants. Are we willing to also be his prophets? I expect the opportunity is going to come. We face very exciting times. And if we want to put a name on this generation, and if you want a name or a title for this particular message, let's call it the most exciting generation. That doesn't necessarily say anything about anyone's or society's rightness in anything. But it's certainly going to be exciting. We're going to live through some of the things that we like to go and see in our entertainment. We like movies that are violent. Okay? We're going to live through something like that, but in a reality. We're on the threshold, I believe, of that period in time when all of these prophecies that we have understood for so many years are going to change from being just conceptions. They're going to become a reality. We're going to live these things. And as we understand them, and as we understand where they're going to go and where they're going to lead, we should be able to do it with faith, with confidence, because we know the end result. We know the outcome. This world is not going to come to an end, but it is going to dramatically change from one society into another. We're going to see the millennial reign of Jesus Christ and his Spirit-born saints. And we're going to see an age beyond that time when the rest of the world, who in their lifetimes, for more than 6,000 years, hasn't had a clue. Well, God has made a plan for them too. It'll come a little later, but we can be confident that God intends that not any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. We're going to be a part of that. We're going to live through it. We're going to see it. And frankly, I believe that we're going to be witnesses, like it or not, of what we know. God will do nothing, but He reveals it first to His servants, the prophets. He says that in both the Old and New Testament. We can believe it, and we can face the days ahead with confidence.